Hey everyone, thanks for joining me today. This is the Faraway Farm Boy podcast, and I'm your host, Dustin. In this episode, I talk about the Dairy Code of Practice revision and why you should care. Before I get to that, I'd like to give a shout out to the folks that make this show possible. This podcast is made possible by Livestock Veterinary Services in Pitcher Butte, Alberta. Livestock Veterinary Services provides a wide range of services for livestock, including dairy herd management, cow-calf herd management, advanced reproduction services, medicine and surgery, and many more. If you're ready to see their expert veterinary team, call Livestock Vet Services today at 403-732-5322 or make an appointment at livestockvet.ca. This podcast is sponsored by Trow Nutrition. As leaders in animal nutrition, Trow Nutrition prides themselves in working with Canadian dairy farmers. Trow understands the importance of bringing innovative nutritional solutions to your operations to maximize herd efficiency. Call your nearest Trow Nutrition location today to learn more about their innovative calf nutrition program. This podcast is also sponsored by Chinook Dairy Service. Did you know that Chinook Dairy Service can fine-tune and optimize the performance of all brands of milking equipment? Call Chinook for a free milking system evaluation today. Today's guest is a farmer from Barnwell, Alberta. He milks 280 cows with his family and is current chair of Alberta Milk. Please welcome the very talented Mr. Stuart Booby. Stuart, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dustin.
I want to talk about the Dairy Animal Care Code of Practice. I think I got the name right.
Yeah.
But I just want to run through your farm history and let people know who you are and what you do. And so who do you tell people you are right now, like your title? If you see someone on a plane or something, who do you say? Oh, I'm CEO of, what do you say?
I'm a dairy farmer.
Yeah, you work. I always tell people I work at a dairy farm. Otherwise, I get strange looks. Like, oh, so it's your dad's, or yeah, whatever. It's the Banks. My dad's. I don't care.
Yeah, no. I just say I'm a dairy farmer. I guess at my age, they probably figure I'm the owner or something, or yeah, part owner, or co-owner, so. Or whatever. Yeah, I hope so by now. I guess so. And a lot of times they say on a plane is a good example. They'll say, "What do you do for work?" And my line for probably 20 years already is, I don't work, I farm.
Yeah.
It's been my whole life.
Raised. Get you right in the feels.
Yeah. It's just,
I grew up. It's not a business, it's a way of life.
Yeah. Although it is a business, but that's not, and of course you have to make a living and make money, but I grew up on a farm. My whole family farms.
So you started out in Abbotsford, you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah, just north of Abbotsford. My dad actually started dairying in the 60s. His father did not dairy, so he got into the dairy business in the early 60s. Bought his own farm, I believe, the year I was born, 1967. Okay. Built that up. I worked there, obviously, through my schooling years.
How many acres did he start with?
I believe in 1967 he bought 65 acres.
Okay.
Yeah.
For some pocket lint.
Yeah, I think $65,000, which was a lot of money at that time.
That's right. Yeah, it is a lot of money. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he built a brand new freestall barn the year I was born, 1967.
Freestalls?
Yes.
In 67. Okay. 67. So that was like the new thing, probably.
And he put upright silos in with automatic feeding, and he was the leading edge at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Still milked in a flat parlor at the time, stanchions. And then I believe in 1975. Built his own parlor. I started milking in it when I was 13, I think. I was fairly tall for my age. I started milking. I was milking on my own Saturday afternoons, Sunday afternoons by the time I was 14. Worked there through high school. And then when I was in grade 12, I have some of my older brothers went to UBC, went to university. I didn't want to. It wasn't my thing. I tolerated school. My parents said I had to graduate, so I did. Had no interest in going to college or university, so I went and worked full-time for my parents.
It's the right choice, or what do you think?
Oh, it was a thing of beauty. But my dad, I found out later, my father has passed away now, but my mother's still alive. But he was really, really good to work for. So it was already a corporation, and he actually called me an employee. I was not a hired man. I was an employee. And
that's, you found out later because you worked at other places later.
No, I never worked anywhere else. I only ever worked for him. but how he treated me.
Okay.
I'm at that time, just for example, the accountant came to the farm. At 14 years old, I sat at the accountant's meeting. Didn't say a word.
It's pretty helpful, right? That's one of the things I struggle with now, like how my relationship is supposed to be with bankers and so on and stuff like that. Because you just don't learn that stuff in high school, right? It's just like something you have to learn on the job. How do you talk to your accountant? Somebody said how you talk to your accountant versus how you talk to your banker is how you talk to your mom after a weekend of partying versus how you talk to your buddies, right?
Okay.
So little quotes like that always help me out.
Yeah. I'm the youngest of four sons. So my oldest brother was already working for my dad for, 8 years by the time I came home. And we just went from there. We expanded our dairy, or he expanded his dairy. I was definitely working for him. I was never a partner with him, with my parents. So we got quite aggressive then, buying land, and we bought two other farms, actually, or my dad did. And my older brother split off, and then another brother came home, and I was working with two older brothers and my dad till 1995. And then we decided we all wanted to go our separate ways. We didn't want to farm. I get along well with my brothers, but we did not want to farm together once we owned it. So we had three farms in Abbotsford area, so my brothers took those, and I moved out to Tabor. I have family in Coaldale, cousins and aunt and uncles and stuff. So we moved out here, 1995, took over.
You were married then?
Yeah. Okay. So I got married in 93. We just had, or 92. We just had one daughter when we moved to Tabor. And we bought a farm that was in big trouble. Was leased by someone else and it was just not going well. So it was for sale and we bought it and had some maintenance issues and an old house and just took it over from there. And my dad fronted me some money and we went to the bank and borrowed a whole whack more and dove in head first.
Wow. That's, there's a lot of work in there too over the last, that'd be...
So I started full time in 85. So I'm 37 years in.
Yeah. Hmm. And where's your farm at today?
So we're 4 miles west of Tabor. The reason I moved to southern Alberta is we had land in the Fraser Valley and we grew corn since the 60s, I believe, and grass. But I wanted to make sure that I like the farming part and I like the dairy part. I like both. So I wanted to make sure I had enough land to feed whatever cattle I had and maybe make some extra or do some cash cropping on the side. And we've done that off and on. So we farm 4 miles west of Tabor, right in the heart of, it used to be mostly sugar beets. Now it's a lot of potatoes and sugar beets and row crops.
Yeah, crazy, crazy amount of irrigation.
Yeah, irrigation here. It's fairly sandy land, sandy loam. So definitely... we used to try to grow alfalfa in our dry land corners, and a lot of them now we don't even bother anymore. We've moved pivots around. We'll have short pivots and pivot corners. Like there's years we did most of that 2 years ago, and the 5 years before that, I said I think I seeded five times and harvested once. Like it was just, it's so dry here if we get in late July, August. So
yeah.
So we try to irrigate every whatever we can.
Right. And you got the the wiper blades on the corners of your
pivots? Yeah, so we have a corner arm if we need it. We have some coulees in our land, so sometimes the pivot works well because the coulee's at an angle or whatever. So we don't have a lot of dry corners. We try to irrigate everything we own.
Yeah,
we do have some, but it may be 30 acres left, 20 acres left.
And then you milk 280. You said?
Yeah, we milk around 280. We have milked more, but right now we're around 280, twice a day.
And then you guys feed all your own stuff, basically.
So we grow alfalfa and corn, and we also grow some wheat on when we seed alfalfa. So we feed all that, and then what we do with corn is we first make silage, and once we have enough silage, we wait about 10 days, and we make high moisture corn or earlage, cobblage, depends what you want to call it, harvested at about 30% moisture. Just the cob and whatever the header will grab. So, but
Do you run it at like a 4 feet high then?
Yeah. Or? So we try not get any stalk is what you try to do.
Okay.
And you try don't get the husk either, but you do get some husks depending on the weather and whatever. So it's about 80. We figure our yardage that we make is 82 to 85% grain by Great. Weight.
And then, so how do you get your header that high actually? I'm just thinking high. About this more.
We have it just a regular cloth chopper and
yeah.
with an adapter on it, and it just, it will lift that high.
Okay, okay. Yeah.
But it does, like a corn header pulls the stalk down as well, right? So it'll just, you don't get any stalk below the cob, which is where the stalk is the thickest. You'll get a little bit of stalk above the cob, but.
Right. So. And then you cut, how do you cut the stalks then?
Like we shred them with a shredder, and then we some of it we work in, and some of it we'll bale if we have time. And
right, but they're like 4 feet high,
or yeah, what? Yeah, we just have a shredder.
Shredder,
yeah, like a you can use a Schulte mower and just
beat it and, yeah, and just then we, beat them up and then yeah, you windrow them.
Then we windrow them later. Yeah.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's something that I haven't really seen done. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have all your young stock here. We kind of did a really nice tour there. So I'm just trying to remember all that stuff.
Yeah. So we grow all our own feed. We buy about 8 pounds of supplement per cow. So say 3 to 4 kilos per cow. We buy some Timothy hay, and then we also sell hay. We sell a fair bit of, we'll sell most of our second cut.
Okay.
And we'll sell some premium hay as well, because we have quite a bit more alfalfa than we need. We also, this year we combined some corn, just because we had a bumper crop this year.
Okay.
And, but yeah, we'll sell, we'll probably sell 30 or 40 semis of hay this year.
40 semis, so yeah. 28 or 30 some bales each.
Oh, 50 bales each. We'll probably sell about 1,000 bales of hay this year.
To Green Prairie? Or
no, actually a lot of time family at the coast. And then the second cut actually goes to my calf grower actually quite often. We'll sell him hay.
I just brought some to the coast. It was 300 and some relative feed value
from
ours, a guy by me.
Yeah, so we had some this year. It was 330.
Our no first way.
Cut, fourth cut. We just sold it actually.
Rocket fuel.
Rocket fuel. Yeah, we didn't even feed it ourselves. We sold it actually.
Yeah, and then guys in BC will feed it at like half a pound inclusion. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I think that's all we sold this year. Yeah, so some corn and a fall. Oh, and we sold a little bit of silage too, but not just a minor amount. We have plenty of feed. On an average year, we have plenty of feed.
So new barn plans then? If you got lots of feed and lots of land, then...
Yeah, so right now we're pretty much, all our buildings are full. And so we actually have to, I've got a 6-year-old permit. I have a 3-year-old permit. You're allowed 1 year or a 3-year extension from the NRCB. So I have a plan to build on my main barn.
Okay.
Because we're full. So we will probably add on this area.
But that's kind of the general plan, is to expand for your son and... whatever.
Yeah, not real rapidly. Like out of the 25, or I guess since 95. So this is the 27th year. We're entering our 27th year of dairying on our own, my wife and I. I think I've probably bought quota 20 of those years, I would think.
So always real slow.
Yeah, just 5 kilos, 10 kilos a year. I think the most I've ever bought in a year is maybe 30.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been just recently. But yeah, right now, our son doesn't need to get a lot bigger. I probably just have our one son, Will Dairy. So he's not really pushing to get way bigger. We might, if we have an opportunity or whatever, and certainly when you have a bigger barn, you'll probably tend to fill it at some point. But
right. What barriers do you see to expanding? Like for me, it's, like I want to get up to 200 cows as you know, quickly as possible, right?
Right.
But as soon as you get to 200, from 200 to let's say 400, you know, you got to buy a chopper or stuff like that. You know, got to buy some iron, or is there stuff like that you see or whatever?
So people have asked if I have a 5-year plan. If I've ever had a 5-year plan. We've never done that. We just look for opportunity. So we started with 80 acres, and now we own, I don't know, 600 or 700. I guess 700, I think.
The barn is kind of the biggest barrier then, right?
Yeah. So we bought, we filled up the old barn, then we built another one, and then we added a pack barn a few years later. I guess that's 5 years ago too already. And then, right now we have heifers inside. We could go back to putting milk cows inside and build some heifer corrals.
Right.
So we're always looking for expansion. I think now at my age and my son's age, or our son's age, we probably won't be as aggressive right now. I'm not exactly sure, although it could change too once, like I say, we are for sure, well, 95% sure we're going to add on the barn this year. Mm-hmm. And then we'll see what happens.
See what the price of lumber does.
Yeah, just everything. Everything. And even, you know, obviously when you have a dairy, or you've had debt. I've carried debt my entire life since I started dairying. And, you know, there's a right level of debt that I like. And so,
yeah.
And, you know, maybe we'll add something in when the right time comes.
As long as it's good debt.
Yep. not new shiny pickups. That's yeah. Bad debt.
Yeah, John Deere disease or yeah. Whatever they call it.
Oh, yeah. And we have some of that, but yeah, we do farm a fair bit. So right. We do buy, not very often, new tractors, but we'll buy yeah. Good used. But yeah.
So I guess your other role is chairman. You want to talk a bit about that?
So I think I've been a delegate for Alberta Milk for 11 or 12 years. About 6 or 7 years ago, I got challenged by one of our local board members that, you know, either be a delegate or, and, you know, get in more involved. I was just on one committee just because of my distance to the milk board office and stuff. So I got challenged, and then it was someone retired from the board early. There was a 1-year term available at the AGM, and somebody said, you should just go for it. And I asked my wife. My wife was with me at the AGM, and I jumped at it. And so I got on the board. And
but somebody said, "If stop complaining or be a delegate."
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, that was just, I was a delegate. And they said, well, if you're going to be a delegate for a long time, what's your goal? Are you going to just be a delegate? Or maybe you should, you know, would you ever consider running for the board? And just because I'm a...
Because you're power hungry. I mean,
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was really it. Yeah, yeah. And bored too. But anyway, so I just took this 1-year term, and it was a pretty spur of the moment. I had talked about it with other people, but I hadn't really thought of it. But there was this 1-year term, so I could just, well, literally dip my toe in the water and see right. If I could run my farm, because I don't have family that, my wife can run my farm, but our farm, but she doesn't love to be in the barn, is generally yeah. Not in the barn.
Right.
We had 5 children at the time at home. So, but anyway, there was a 1-year term, so I got involved and I loved it. We made it work. I have a herdsman that's worked for us for a number of years. So then I took, so the next year I had to get reelected, and I took a 3-year term, but right away I got again challenged by other board members, and I got on the executive my second year on the board. So I became second vice chair. And, the third year, I think I was 2 years a second vice chair, and then I was 2 years the vice chair. And at that time, then we were actively talking about, well, if you're the vice chair, you know, will you step up to being the chair once?
You know, right, but you had already been chair.
Nope.
You just got on the board. Okay,
yeah,
you're
a director. I just got on the board. Yeah, I was still under director for 1 year. I was second vice chair for 2 years, and I was vice chair for 2 years.
Okay.
Or 1 year. I'm not sure. 1 or 2 years. But anyway, so yeah, it just came over time. I was very interested in the national issues and the regional issues. And so, yeah, I became chair just over a year ago. A year and 15 months ago, I guess.
So what have you all seen since then? I mean, we got a few big things.
Well, I guess it came in the middle of COVID, so it's been
a challenge. That's always fun.
Yeah, it was. We've had some challenges. Of course, when you're the vice chair and second vice chair, you're on the executive, so you travel interprovincially and in the West, and I went to Ottawa a number of times.
Yeah, so that's very interesting, because I want to do that someday, because then you see the bigger picture, right? You can see what we want to do with the Western Milk Pool,
yeah.
And I don't know what interests me about it, but I don't know, just seeing the bigger picture and how it all kind of fits together.
Yeah, so that's what I got. As soon as I got on the executive, you start traveling and meeting people and board members from other provinces. So that got the juices flowing, just because of my history in the dairy industry, my family's history in the dairy industry, my wife's family's history in the dairy industry. My father-in-law actually was a board member, milk board member in BC for probably 10 years a while back. So that all of that was part of it. And then I found out once I got on the board that I actually had... I like to read. I'm not a guy that goes to conferences or stuff like that, and not much. I just like to read. I mean, I've read Hordes of Dairymen since I was probably 10 years old. And so I just got involved. You know, I found out I knew a fair bit about the dairy industry, but I just wanted to, you know, keep the dairy industry going. And it's changed a lot over time, and it will continue to change, and just, yeah, to be involved in that.
Mm-hmm. I guess the biggest thing that people are talking about is our price of milk going up.
Right.
So what are some of the challenges associated with that? Like you talked before about, you know, if we go up too much, as with any product that anyone sells, you know, you're afraid of what the consumer is going to do.
Yeah, so I have a friend, like I mentioned to you before, that used to dairy in Canada, now dairies in the U.S. And we can say whatever we want about the systems and how they work differently. But you just cannot, Canada is not an island. You cannot just continually raise the milk price and not have concerns about border pressure and whatever. So, I mean, sure, the costs have gone up and there's no doubt about it. And I have no problem with the price increase. You could argue whether it had to be that much or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's based off a formula somewhat. So, I mean,
right.
So we took it, but I get nervous now about where we're at and what that's going to mean to the industry.
Not necessarily the end consumer, but the processor and how that all works? Or
yeah, I think, you know, I worry about the U.S. border. The nice thing is, I guess, for us, is the U.S. costs are going up as well. But I just think you cannot have that big a price difference between Canada and the U.S. without, you know, continually dealing with issues. I mean, CUSMA, you know, we have more imports again. I would be concerned if we keep signing trade agreements that we wouldn't give more of our market away because our price is so high. I mean, we have the highest farm gate price in the world if you look at it. So, I mean, there's only one thing.
You know, farm gate, not
farm retail. Gate. So the farmer price, right, is the highest in the world. So that makes me somewhat nervous.
But we don't have the highest retail price, right?
No.
Like if you average out all dairy products.
Yep.
So how where is money lost on the processor then?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons for that on why that happens. I mean, I'm not saying we have to take less for our milk. I just worry about increasing it more, I guess, would be my argument.
Well, like if feed went up 20%
right.
and fertilizer tripled.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with taking an 8%. Increase.
Yeah, I realize that, but I mean,
that's a short-term kind of like thought, but
there are efficiencies to be gained by, I think our industry can become somewhat more efficient, and it doesn't mean you've got to milk 1,000 cows, but there's no reason why things can't be made a little bit more efficient than maybe some things happen now. So,
but that's the quickest way to become more efficient, right? Like if you look at the U.S. system, it's bigger farms, right?
Right.
So I mean, the consumer likes that smaller farm, right? Is that?
Yeah. Yes and no. I mean, I've been on, they do, but will they pay for it is the next question, right? They say they will, but I mean, and a lot of people will tell you they don't like Walmart either, but why is Walmart the biggest retailers in the world, right? Yep. Because the price is right.
Uh-huh.
So, I think we have to watch it. That's all I say. I'm not saying it's, you know, has to change or whatever. I'm just saying we better pay attention.
Yeah. So, that's actually a perfect segue into our, what we really want to talk about. We got some suggestions from staff to talk about the, code of practice revision.
Well, as I mentioned before, I've been involved in the dairy industry a long time and society has changed in the 30 some years that I've dairied. And there are different pressures as far as, you know, animal welfare and just how society looks at animals and the dairy industry needs to be ahead of that. Not catching up, it needs to be ahead of it. So,
but there's at every meeting we have someone who stands up and I've thought this too, like when do we stop cowering to consumers' demands, right? Or this is the same as any producer in any industry or anything would, you know,
right.
Would say where, you know, but you always have to listen to the consumer too. So,
well, in the end, we don't have much of an industry if we don't have any consumers.
That's so right. Yeah. But
so there's a balance,
but obviously. You know what I'm saying, right? Yeah. Like,
yep. Look at, so for instance, if you just look at other industries, I mean, the hog industry is farrowing crates are done.
Yeah.
I mean, egg laying,
yeah.
The nest, you know, chickens in a little cage, that's done.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, this code, it addresses tethering of cattle.
So that's a specific revision.
Specific revision. I mean, I said to you already, my dad built a freestall barn in 1967. I had my calves tethered for a while on hutches, but we put them in behind a little fence, 20 years ago already. I mean, I haven't tethered anything in my career.
Yeah. So, but you're saying if it doesn't affect you personally on the farm, because that's a feeling that a lot of producers have, they're not going to go and comment on this revision process.
Right.
And, you know, and all the animal welfare people are going to comment for right. sure, right?
Right.
Because I did the same thing. I went through the list, you know, briefly when it came out a month ago, and it's like, well, none of this really pertains to me. I'm not going to comment anything because it's all kind of okay. They're not going to listen to me anyway. Why should I comment, right? But
right.
But if they only hear from the animal rights people, the council that puts the code of practice together and revises it, you know, they have little to go on.
Right. But. No, I haven't sent my reply to them yet in either yet, but I don't have a problem with a lot of it. Now, there are some specific things that I think, you know, as dairy farmers, you should probably, again, pay attention.
But that's what I'm saying. It doesn't affect you personally on the farm, so then you're reluctant to comment on it, right? Or what?
Well, I'm
if because you don't tether calves, but I tether calves, so like I made sure I commented on that. But
if society doesn't want animals tethered anymore, and there are plenty of ways to do it in a different way.
That's true. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you look at, for instance, I'm just going to use this as an example because I talked to somebody else about it already. Tie stalls, right? Milking cows in tie stalls. Well, now the code is going to say you have to let them go. I believe it's every day, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Exercise
or whatever, right? And, you know, I've been to tie stall. I've never milked in a tie stall. I've always milked in a parlor. But having a cow tied up for that long is not that good for the cow either. Mm-hmm. The other thing it is a tie stall barn, you can, you know, I'm sure I'll get pushback on this, but it's not the most efficient way to milk cows, right? It's too slow, right? You cannot, I mean, I milk, you know, I used to milk in a double four. Now I milk in a double 15, still with one guy.
You're going to get some calls from Quebec.
Well, it could be, but I mean, and I'm not saying those are poor farmers. I'm just saying you need to look at what the rest of the world does and go, yeah. Can that work on my farm?
I don't know, because like, have you seen Don Chalock's barn? He's got he's got 10 of his show cows or whatever on. I don't know if they're there all the time or whatever, right. But they're beautiful animals, very well taken care of, right?
Right.
So it's like,
well, if somebody wants to milk in a tie stall and let them go every day, it's fine with me.
Right. There's right. some amendments you can make.
Sure.
So that was one specific thing that I think right. comes into effect in 10 years or something.
Yeah, 10 years from now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a few other ones. I'll just go through the ones that I commented on because I think they might be examples of what other people find interesting as well. And it took me like 20 minutes to go through and comment on it. I would just Google code of practice, dairy animal code of practice. That's the easiest way to get to the website and comment on it. Yeah, tethering calves. Yeah, the other one was the electric prod use. I know this is going to make me look like I use the prod like every day, but they said they were going to phase out the use of electric prods in 10 years. I don't know why the date is there. Like, what is it? To get people used to not?
Yeah, to find different ways, right? Different methods, right?
But like, let's be honest here. When we're loading cattle of any sort, there's been a situation where you're like, okay, am I going to wait 2 hours for this heifer to climb on board this trailer? You know, everything else is perfect, but you're going to wait there for that heifer to board that trailer, or are you going to use a prod, quick sec, done, right?
Well,
You don't, maybe you don't have to say anything. But
well, the prod is interesting. So for years, we never had a prod here.
Okay.
But then
you might be the one farm.
Well, no, but then I'll tell you what happened, right? You end up giving the swift kick, right? Which is one, you hurt your foot.
Yeah.
And two, the cow doesn't really notice. All you did was scare it, right?
Yeah.
A prod can be a very useful thing, but the problem is, you know, if you work with cattle all the time, 365 days a year, and the prod's laying around, there can be abuse of it. I said there can be. Doesn't have to be. But for years on my farm, I was the only one allowed to use the prod. And I probably had four or five other people always.
So now we're bubble wrapping our industry. This is the same thing we do in our society too, right?
Right. Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's the greatest thing ever, but I would say, you know, at one time I used to kind of scoff at Temple Grandin, right? Like, well, come on, whatever, right? Well,
cow handling and that sort of thing.
Cow handling and that sort of thing. And I mean, I've done it on my own farm. I used to have a hoof trimming chute in a corner.
Right.
Well, I put it in the middle of the alley and put a light in front of it. You don't even have to chase the cow, and the cow walks in by itself.
Yeah.
Right. There are ways. Just for an example, the other night we had to load some cows to take to the auction, slaughter cows. And it was already dark, and my trailer, the light bulb burnt out on the inside of my trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was trying to load it with my son, and we were both behind the cows. And I said to him, why don't you go to the front of the trailer and turn your phone flashlight on? And he kind of looked at me. I said, they'll go right in. And they walked right in.
Hmm.
Because a cow does not, I mean, read Temple Grandin or read anybody, any animal. They don't like going in a dark spot.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of ways, a lot of things that you can change, and it'll work actually better. Now, is phasing out the prod something better? I think I've been around a long time. I've seen the prod used plenty of times in the wrong manner. So that, I think that's the reason.
I've never been around the situation.
No, never. That's amazing. I guess, well, I'm older than you, so I guess maybe that's why.
There was a few other ones that, these are all kind of, like most of the revisions were pretty straightforward. Like, you got to feed your calves water and stuff right. like that. I mean, do I kind of disagree with the science behind, like, a 2-day old calf has to have water? It's not going to drink the water, but what do I care? I'm going to put some water next to it, right?
Right.
A lot of these revisions are pretty simple.
Right.
I guess there's a few that I kind of balked at. There was one where it said you're not allowed to move cows with hip lifters.
Right.
Which made sense, but they don't specify how far.
Right.
Like, they said it was just a thing where, like, you know, they should probably put a number on that or whatever. So,
well, it's interesting, the hip lifter one, because again, I'm old enough that the barn was too low to lift with a hip lifter. You couldn't get above it, right? So, I mean, I've been in barns like that, right? So,
yeah.
We rolled them onto a skid and dragged them outside, and I would say 90% of those cows got up on their own without the use of a prod, by the way, too. But anyway, I was also once at an ag show, actually in California, and they actually had a front end loader bucket that was made for moving cows. Like, it was all plastic on the inside and
sloped,
no square corners, like no sharp corners, all rounded.
Okay.
And there are ways. I mean, most farms have a skid steer now.
Yeah,
there are better ways to move down cows around.
I know. Yeah, right. But some of these things are binding, right? Like,
right.
if you say you're never allowed to move a cow with hip lifters, and then someone has a situation where you have to move that cow even an inch or something,
right.
All of a sudden he's going to jail for 6 months because the code, you know, made it, you know.
Yeah, I think it'll be interpreted, though. I mean, it's about reasonable, though, right? So
I don't know. Like, I don't know.
I don't know exactly what the wording is right now, but I mean, a hip lifter should be exactly that, just for lifting.
I totally agree. This is making me sound like I move cows around with hip lifters all day long. You drive
a quarter mile?
Yeah. No, it doesn't happen. And I have rolled cows into buckets before, and it's way more gentle, provided that cow doesn't... Right.
But I mean, there's no doubt if you have a cow stuck in a freestall too far forward because it slept or got pushed there or whatever. I mean, lifting a cow backwards in a freestall 3 feet... should not be illegal.
Yeah, I hope it's not like super binding, where because you know it's only going to progress from here. Where, you know, once this is in place, and it might be another 20 years, but they're going to say you're not even allowed to use hip lifters.
Right.
You know, it's an eyesore or whatever.
They'll have an airbag that you can
push a cow and roll that's a cow. That's true, right? Trust the progression of technology, I guess, to some point.
Exactly.
So yeah, our staff really wants more inclusion on this as far as more comments from producers, so they suggested that we talk about it on the podcast, to which I said sure, why not. It's dairy related, so
and like I said, I know a lot of my family dairies, or most of my family dairies, there are better ways to do things. I think that's the one thing, and I don't mind, like I say, I haven't gone line by line through the code yet. But to say there's not better ways than we used to do things. There's no doubt. I mean, a lot of parlors at one time used to have steps in them, right? I mean,
yeah. They used to hang calves upside down on gates, right? Yeah. And the science was there and everyone was gung-ho. Make sure you hang your calf over a gate to get the fluid out of its lungs, right? And sure enough, like now we know the fluid was coming out of their stomach, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we used to pull probably 60% of our calves or 50% of our calves. I mean, you know, now we
see the feet, get the tractor, get the winch.
Exactly. Four guys.
Four-wheel drive.
I don't even own a calving jack anymore. I mean, you don't, you know, if your cows are healthy enough, they should be able to birth naturally. It's just generally things like speaking, that.
Yeah.
And like you say, on the cow handling, my brother has a degree in animal science from UBC, and he's 6 years older than me. And he told me one time, I was probably 16 years old, and he was at UBC, and we were chasing a cow across the barn. And he says, anytime you can hear their feet slapping on the concrete, you're actually injuring your cow. He said, you should never make a cow run, never push it that hard. And if you look on the science of that, they'll get blood blisters in their feet from running on concrete. So just things like that. We've talked about it on our own farm, just, if you can hear a cow move on concrete, it's probably hurting itself.
Yeah, they definitely, there's definitely a science to it. I remember going to a cow handling little conference that they had growing up, and it was eye-opening, like how a cow pinpoints on her shoulder. She always, like if you stand right beside a cow and stand ahead of her shoulder, she'll move back and stand, you know. It's just little things about cow handling that change the way you handle cows. So they move way slower than we do, right?
Yep. And you know, that's just a better way. And in the end, people say, well, it's going to hurt the industry. Well, I think a relaxed cow and a cow that's calm will probably have more efficient production. So there's nothing wrong with it. It's just, you need to learn.
Yeah.
And your facilities, there's no doubt that the facilities do make a difference.
Yeah. But on the other side of things, we do a lot of paperwork. So what would you say to those people? Like we do a pile of paperwork.
So does everybody else. I have friends in the construction industry that, you know, that are my age.
Right.
Right. I mean, 30 years ago it was gung-ho, no WCB, no straps, no nothing. Just give her, climb up the roof and fall off. Yeah. Right. It's a style of business, right? I mean, they've got everything documented too. I mean, I'm from the Fraser Valley. You don't build an outhouse there without an inspection, right? So you gotta do paperwork. So that's just the society we live in. I mean, we used to handwrite everything. Now you can have it on your iPhone. I mean, it's pretty quick. You can have programs set up. I don't know that it's that terrible. Like
bigger picture, I think it's good for the industry. That way we can kind of connect with consumers a bit more.
Right.
You know, they know we have some quality assurance program in place.
Yep. Yep. They're not going to accept just farmer's word anymore because, you know, we've all seen the YouTube videos, which, you know, is sure a very, very minor part of our industry, or animal egg in any industry, but that has a bearing on our industry too. So I don't think the paperwork is that terrible, actually. Like I hate paperwork. My wife does the office work, so that shows you how much I like paperwork.
But, so you get to hear about it.
But I mean, there are ways, and I think once you have the system in place, I don't think it's a pile of work.
Yeah. But yeah, you were saying in potatoes, there's
lots of paperwork. I'm in the middle of the potato industry, or I have a very close friend that is in the potato industry, and their paperwork is more rigorously inspected, inspected more often. I mean, they pretty much know every potato that hits a potato French fry factory, which fuel it came from. So, I mean, there's ways to do it. I mean, sure. I think that the biggest deal with paperwork is when you make changes and you got to learn a new system.
Yeah. But no one likes change, right? Nope. Especially the process of change. Right. Once they're changed over, then it's fine, right?
Yeah. I mean, years ago, we didn't, you know, our cows had names and didn't have ear tags, and then you got forced into ear tags. Like, come on, really? How do you farm without an ear tag, right? Like,
I actually have like two cows without ear tags right now, and it's been like a month.
Yeah, so right. I mean, it's just something to get used to. I mean, my whole career, when I farmed with my dad, we did AI. So, I mean, that was always written down. There was always a paperwork trail on every calf. I have a purebred herd. It's been followed for 50 years. Like, it's not that big a deal once you get the system.
Yeah. What else is next for the industry in our province?
In our province?
I guess it's looking more like it's not going to matter what happens in our province. It's more Western Milk Pool and that level of things.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Next week, actually, we're going to the Western Milk Pool Forum in Calgary. We're going to talk about working more closely together with the Western Milk Pool. There are national issues that we've got to deal with. Obviously, we haven't been meeting in person in a while. But yeah, as far as the province, I know 2 years ago we went to a conference, the Western Milk Pool had a conference, and somebody drew a map of Canada without borders in the West. And I think that's really where we're headed. Every producer in the West will get treated the same. The milk travels here, there, and everywhere. Not always to our benefit, but that's where the processors are. So we'll be working definitely within the four Western provinces. That'll be... I'll be very surprised if it doesn't happen in the near future.
What's the main draw behind that? Just cost savings?
Cost savings, yeah.
Or how we negotiate with processors?
Exactly, both of those. So we're not going to pay less on administration, but it's to try to keep our administration costs in check. There's no reason to have, staff members in every province doing the same thing for just that province. You might as well streamline the process. And then as well, our processors are most of them are interprovincial. So why wouldn't you, on some things, we need some leverage to work with other provinces, to work with our processors. I mean, that's just the way the industry is going.
I see. And then I guess there's DIW, which is always, what can you tell us about that?
Well, it is has been an interesting ride. I think.
You didn't see all this stuff coming?
Well, we knew it was going to be difficult to get it going. I think the original plan was that we would be putting milk through there by now. And so far, we've bought land and haven't poured any concrete yet. The problem is we've had some legal issues. There's no doubt about it. That's the one thing I will say. The provinces, like the Western Milk Pool, is more than willing to work together. But we've had very many meetings with lawyers, and lawyers have been meeting with lawyers to try just get the details ironed out.
With the plant itself?
With the plant itself and the agreement. The producers will end up, paying for the plant and then saving the money through transportation. But how do you do that legally, right? Interprovincially, that was really the problem. So we've spent almost a year trying to work those kinks out.
So that's all dealing with the plant itself. What about the product that's going through the plant? What can you tell us about what's going on there?
So we have supply agreements that are in front of the processors right now. They're working on them. We have one processor that is signed up to take product from DIW. We have other ones that want to take product. But again, it's in the details. So you get it in front of lawyers. You're not taking whole milk anymore because there is dewatered milk is basically what I call it. That leads to issues because if you look at our regulations, they talk about selling milk to processors. Well, if you take the water out of milk, it's not milk anymore. It's mostly milk, but it's not, by definition, not the same. So you need to deal with that.
Right. So then it's processed milk.
Wow, but we don't want to call it processed milk because we're not allowed to process it as a board. So that there you go. There you go.
What do you want to call it? You give it a number or something?
Well, we're going to say that we're going to assign a processor milk. The farmers will ship the milk. It'll just go through DIW and get the water out so we can haul it more efficiently. So in the end, the processor will take what was milk and with water out. But that's just a legal agreement.
So what I'm wondering what the name on the bottle of on the other end of the plant, what was milk, is going to be.
But that's almost every milk. I mean, you have 2% milk. They still call it milk. Even though there's butterfat taken out of it.
What was milk?
What was milk? Now it's just 2% milk. So
buy whole milk, everyone.
Well, in Fairlife, milk has protein added, right? So,
more than just what was milk.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. Better than milk or whatever. Depends how you want it.
Okay. So, with DIW, there's some finagling.
Yeah. And it's ongoing. But like I say, the board, like the Alberta board, the four Western boards, there's no hold up on what we want to do.
Right.
It's just the process of getting it done.
Huh.
Legally.
Cool. So when's it going to be done? That's what people want to know, right?
I'll get done as soon as possible.
Shoot. Because as soon as we get that, I've told you before, as soon as we get that, then we get an increase, right? Because then we have more processing. Right. And then I can buy more cows and milk more cows, right?
That would be a great theory. Yes. Yeah. That is the hope. Yeah.
Is
the goal.
What comes first? Because I think we talked about this before. So if we somehow get more processing in the West, broadly speaking,
yeah,
then I get increases, or when do I get my increases?
Well, market has to wait.
Yeah.
We have market, you know, people talk about quota. We should just talk about market share quota. You have a share of the market. So the market has to grow in order for a producer to get more quota. So right now, because we're maxed out on processing, we cannot, if we would get more quota, we can't process the milk anyway.
Yeah, we need more people in the West to drink more milk before Saputo goes, oh, I'm going to build another plant in Lethbridge.
Well, yeah. Or, I mean, it's interesting how the market works. Some of our processing is not going full bore, but that's because if your processing plant makes a certain type of cheese and there's no more market for that type of cheese, why would the milk plant buy more of our milk? That makes no sense if you can't sell it.
It's very depressing. When I found out some of my milk was being handled in that direction, it sucked.
Yeah, but that's, you know,
that's
the way the industry is. The producers don't own processing, so you're dealing with a buyer, right? A milk buyer.
Yeah.
But no, back to DIW, the idea is, and there is a processor building at the same time as we're building DIW. They will expand.
Really?
Yes.
Can you tell us where at?
It's a PLR provider, so Vitalis in Abbotsford.
Oh, I see. Yeah, they're expanding. Right.
They have expansion plans. That's all in the works. They're working on it.
I was going to ask how that affected us, but if we get DIW going, obviously
the milk will go there. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So some of the milk from DIW will go there. So that is ongoing. Although, again, there's been issues with Vitalis as well and their process of. I mean, you don't just triple the size of your milk plant overnight.
Yeah, like especially in the middle of the city
That area. And then in the middle of COVID as well.
Right.
So there's been issues, but they have expansion plans in the works. So that's happening. And we have other plants interested in the output from DIW, but we don't have contracts in place.
I see.
That's about as much as I can say right now.
Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. Another thing I don't know too much about is the grocery code of conduct.
Yes.
Do you know more about that?
What's happening with, so we just see a lot of issues from the producer side. When you go to national meetings, you hear other sides of the story, and what processors deal with is some of the, because the retail market in Canada is basically owned by four major corporations. They sometimes, what happens now is they'll order a dairy product if they don't sell it.
Like Sobeys or Walmart or something?
Yeah, one of the bigger ones. Yeah, okay. Sobeys and Walmart are two of the four. I can't think of the other two right now. They won't pay for that product if it expires on their shelves. Well, that's a pretty big issue when you order it and then don't pay for it. So the grocery code of conduct, what it is, I think the first one was in the UK. And what it does is it just says, no, if you place an order to a processor, a retailer places an order to a processor, you can't add extra fees after you basically have a contract.
Hmm.
So the producers and the processors, for once, have to agree on something. And because this affects both the processor, which in turn affects the producer.
They pass that down to us?
Yes. Well, eventually, if they're throwing milk away.
Oh, they just lower the blend price.
Yeah, or whatever. They it's a cost to the processor, right?
Right.
So in the meantime, and it's unfair practice, basically, by a retailer. Because if you've placed an order.
Right.
How is it the processor's problem that you didn't sell it?
So what's stopping us from implementing that with the retailers?
Nothing. It's a matter of getting it done. I mean, you need regulations to put it in place.
Okay.
So that's a lot of that is provincial. So again, you got to work with 10 provinces.
So like someone like Walmart, in the States, they're sourcing their own farms now. So they're kind of like dairy. Well, not like Dairyland, but like they're kind of their own co-op then, right?
Yeah.
So how long until that happens in Canada? Is Saputo too big, or any of the big processors too big for Walmart to do that sort of thing? Or
yeah, Walmart, I don't know all the details of who supplies Walmart. I mean, I think they do work with, and they do flip processors as well, because we've noticed that's what you deal with at the Western Milk Pool, or say at national meetings, is sometimes one of those, a giant retailer like Walmart will flip on, say, where they're sourcing their chocolate milk from, for instance.
Oh.
Well, that has a major effect on the industry, because Walmart has a lot of volume.
Hmm. So, but Walmart won't be sourcing like from individual farms in Canada anytime soon?
I don't think so, because right now the boards, you know, we direct the milk,
right?
So they don't have a relationship with the farmer.
Yeah. Whereas like in the States, like Tyson and stuff, they have their own chicken farms and stuff like that. It's way different.
Yeah. It's vertically integrated there.
Yeah.
I think that's a ways away in Canada's dairy industry.
Right. Huh. Very interesting. What other issues are there on a national scope of things that we're missing out on? I just shovel manure, basically. I do a lot of on-farm stuff, and I know people listening to this are just feeding cows, you know?
So. Right. Well, I think we're still dealing with the effects of CUSMA.
So for sure, yeah.
So that is why processors aren't building as well. I mean, we had a new plant very close to being built in Alberta before CUSMA started, and it would have been done by now. But
dang, eh?
Dang, exactly. So we're still working our way through that. What is the market in Canada? I think it's still unclear. We still expect growth, but that's what we're dealing with as a national issue.
How much growth? What do I need to plan for here, Stuart?
They're still talking 1-2% once COVID is done. So,
So that's just, it's following population growth.
Basically, yeah. Yeah.
And when did the effects of CUSMA wear off? When is that?
Well, the main effect is, it's over time. Over 10 years, but the main effect is now. Last year it started. All those imports came in. This year will be the same. I mean, they're going to import everything that they can.
Right.
But the major import effect is right now, but over time it will lessen as a percentage. So
I see. Yeah, they had a pretty high fill rate on some of the ice cream and stuff like that. Crazy, 90%.
Yeah, butter is almost 100%, right? So, which makes sense. Easy, transportable.
Right.
Right.
Is it going to change now with the vaccination rules for truckers? Or I think it affected 10% of trucking, right?
Yeah, no idea what that would do with the dairy imports. I doubt it.
Yeah.
There's still, well, again, back to what we started talking about, a while ago, is if you can source cheaper butter, for instance, in the U.S.
Yeah.
And you're a processor or a retailer, why wouldn't you import that? That just makes good economic sense.
Like you said, easy to move,
right?
Yeah.
So so that's what we deal as a national industry, as well as the differences between the East and the West on all sorts of issues,
mostly policy. They're not policy on issues. Farm issues, right?
No, it's mostly policy issues. Yeah. So that's what we're trying to work on, and then to agree on anything nationally, one of the issues is every province has a veto. So all 10 provinces have to agree. So that makes negotiations very low, very long, very tedious, very painful. Not the best way to govern an industry, but that's the way it's worked for a long time.
All in all, you'd think that it would be quicker to negotiate. Well, you're negotiating with processors as a Western Milk Pool already, but it would be easier if it was P10.
Yeah, I believe so. But that's an easy word to say, the P10.
Right, yeah.
There's some obstacles in the way before we're there.
Yeah, I just look at how CUSMA was negotiated, and like if we were, co-ops negotiating, trying to, have a hand in how CUSMA went, it would not go as well as it did. Like,
right.
I think, what's his name? Lampron there did a pretty good job. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and DFC has done a wonderful job working with the federal government. So, I mean, I'm a big supporter of DFC. I think we all need to be. But yeah, in the end, there are still governance issues nationally that we're trying to work our way through. I mean, I attend meetings that not a lot gets done because of this. You know, every province has a veto type system.
You need to learn French. If someone learned French and they were from Alberta, I'm pretty sure it would solve most of our problems.
Well, I said an hour ago, I never went to college. I did take 2 years of French and decided it was useless because I was going to spend my life farming, but it would be very handy to speak French right now in my current role as the chair. Yeah. So,
thanks a lot for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Anytime, Dustin.
Thank you for listening to the Faraway Farm Boy podcast, episode number 51 with Stuart Boovy. If you guys like this podcast, you may like the Progressive Dairy podcast. This podcast has been made possible by Chinook Dairy Service. Did you know that Chinook Dairy Service can fine-tune and optimize the performance of all brands of milking equipment? Call Chinook for a free milking system evaluation today. Join me again next time on the Faraway Farm Boy podcast.